to see about Yale. I'm not sure this is the best class to test the waters, but you know. I thought I had this class well trained, and they said they wouldn't disappoint me this week, but sure enough they did. Now what is it, class, that we haven't done today? No. That's very good. We haven't sung the alma mater. I was out in Columbus two nights ago, and I asked the audience to get up and sing the alma mater, and none of them could. So remember, we have our song contest, which part of your grade is based on in December. So I hope you're all thinking. But there's something missing today, and I asked all of you to, so I wouldn't have to say this and embarrass you in front of the group. No.
Your bottle of water.
Well, yeah, my bottle. But that's not your fault. My bottle of water will be here. There's something else. Spatial. There you go. Back row. Let's go up. Come on. No, not you. Not you. My class. Come on. I see some students back there. Who's ever in the back row? Let's go. And you guys promised me that you'd fill in the front row. Not him. You. Come on. Let's go. You're the only one? No other students there? We got room for four. I feel like a lonesome polecat. You guys are really not well behaved, right? And Yale students are supposed to be well behaved. Are there any visitors in this class? Because, I mean, it doesn't look... Oh, one. Okay, well, you're not coming here, too. You're maybe... I will give you my brief advertisement for Yale. It's unsolicited. I'm recording it so the dean can hear. I think Yale, right now, is the best school of architecture in the country. Why do I say that? Because it has the most diversity. That is, it has points of view from right, left, and center. That's number one. Number two, it is the right size. Harvard is too big, Princeton is too small. And Yale is just about the right size, although this class is too big, as any of the students in it will tell you. But better to be a little too big than a little too small. It also has probably the best range of visiting critics in the country, and it also has the best events, that is, lectures, publications, and all sorts of things. What I like about Yale is it's a cross between not being too professional, as Harvard is, and too theoretical, as Princeton is. So Yale falls right in the middle. Anybody who has to ask whether they should go to Yale or go to Harvard should go to Harvard. Anybody that has to ask whether they should go to Yale or Princeton should go to Princeton. All right? Because if you have to ask and you don't know the difference, then you don't want to be here. So that would be my advice. I wouldn't apply to any other school, but that's another thing. Columbia is in transition. I think Columbia is going to be very good. It's also quite large. The only thing that Princeton has in its favor, from what I understand from students, is it pays more money to students and therefore gets a lot of the top students. It's too bad that students have to make their decisions based on money. But so be it. I think that one should visit Harvard and visit Princeton and visit Yale, etc. All right, so that's my announcement. Ted, you want to add anything to that? You agree with those things? Yes, I do, right? Yes, I do. All right? And, okay. This class is a required class for all first-year students, I believe, yes? It is a class which is an introduction to thinking, seeing, and making. Each week we have a two-hour lecture in this room. We then adjourn to the next room where each week the students are required to make a series of analytic drawings. Hey, how are the drawings?
Good.
Good? Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So today we are preempted so that we usually hear from 9:30 to 11:30 and then next door from 11:30 to 12:30. But we're going to be next door from 11 to 12:30. If any of you who are visitors would like to see what it's possible for first-year students to do with no talent, little intelligence and little instruction, you should go next door before you hear the dean. As a matter of fact, the reason why the drawings are so good is I have two very good TAs this year, Neil and Tate. The only reason why they're good is they work for football tickets, and so when I have extra football tickets, they perform. When I don't, they don't. Neil pretends to be a baseball fan, but he only became a baseball fan when the Chicago White Sox won the World Series. The reason why he became a baseball fan is he started the season as a football fan, but his team is what is, we might say, gone into the toilet. And so we don't hear much about football anymore, do I?
When the Eli and I are bad, I can't.
Yes, but you are going to sing for us, right? Not today, but you will sing.
Indeed.
Three songs. So, very good. What we do is run through a series of architects, starting in the Renaissance and coming to the present day. We are at a key moment in the course because we shifted from the Renaissance to the modern last week, and we are in the modern period, and today we're going to study Le Corbusier. Le Corbusier is important in modern architecture because he had what I would consider to be the first diagram of modern architecture. That is, the first critical drawing which attempted to summarize the difference between what was happening in the 19th century and what was happening in the 20th century. In fact, Corbusier not only had a diagram, he had two diagrams. We'll look at those today. Not only did he have two diagrams, but he had a manifesto, the 5 points towards a new architecture, and he also took those 5 points and placed them in four compositions. Corbusier, like Palladio, was very conscious of the need to theorize, publicize, and as far as I can see, the things that he did first were to theorize and publicize, publish and write, and I am convinced that we wouldn't think about Le Corbusier and his little white houses of the 20s had he not theorized about them prior to their building. He was born in Switzerland in a town called Le Chaux-de-Fonds. His father, this was the middle of the Swiss watchmaking industry. His father worked for Swiss watch manufacturers.
He was a minor functionary. And most of the companies were owned by wealthy Jewish merchants. And I believe that Corbu always resented this influence on his life, even though he did his first houses in Le Chaux de Fonds for these very same Jewish merchants, and in fact built for most of his early clients happened to be Jewish. But so there was a very ambivalent feeling about Corbu and his relationship to the idea of the Jew. And of course this rears its head later in Corbu's work in the late 30s, when France is ambivalent about its relationship to Germany, and Corbu comes out not only in favor of Germany but writes texts about the need for war. He also wrote letters to Mussolini wanting to work for Mussolini and the fascist state. In fact, he was invited by Mussolini to go in 1933 to give a series of famous lectures in Italy. All of that, as we have said before in this class, has nothing to do with the greatness of his work. In other words, we don't know the politics of Borromini, we don't know the politics of the Pope who commissioned Borromini, we don't know if he was a fascist or not. And we're going to see this very moment next week when we look at the work of the Italian fascist architect Giuseppe Taranni. I think we are trying in this class to situate people in history, but also, in fact, to understand their work outside of the historical pressures that might have been involved in their personal life. Le Corbusier had a magazine starting in, he was both a painter and an architect, and he worked with his cousin, he first worked with Amédée aux Enfants to work on what was called purist painting. That is a reduction of cubist painting to pure color field abstraction. And a lot of Corbu's work is influenced by this early purist period. It's very different than either late cubism, that is either analytic cubism or synthetic cubism. It's very different than Juan Gris and George Braque and other cubist painters, but nevertheless was very influential on his work and through his life. He always painted. He was always part painter, part architect, although he was a much better architect than he was a painter. He was also a polemicist. And in 1919, just after the war, he started a magazine called L'Esprit Nouveau, the New Spirit. He started this with his cousin, Pierre Jeanrey, and they published 27 issues of the magazine. In this magazine, many of his important articles appeared first, and then they were gathered in the very didactic manifesto, which appeared in 1923, Vers une architecture, which was translated into English, Towards a New Architecture, which tells you how we in the English language distort what is really a title that's toward an architecture. So it's important to understand that Corbu never insisted upon or desired the word new. Now, the two diagrams. And these are going to be very important when we come to the later characters who are trying to escape the influence of Le Corbusier, the characters that populate the schools of architecture in Europe and America today. What Corbu did was to propose in 1914 an icon called the Maison Domino. The Maison Domino was a way of looking at the possibility of reinforced concrete and to propose
a context for using that material that dealt with space in a different way. The Maison Domino was a series of columns and slabs, horizontal slabs. The most important thing about the horizontal slabs was that the ground floor slab was set off the ground, raised off the ground on primitive, what would be called footings traditionally, but they would become what Le Corbusier would call them pilotis, that is, columns that allowed the ground to run free underneath. So these primitive pilotis or footings become the first notion that the ground plane of the land is different than the ground plane occupied within a private house. So now we have this distinction between private and public, not in the vertical plane, that is, not in the facade of the building, which is the traditional way facades separated public and private, but in fact in the horizontal plane. And it was this extension of the horizontal plane, that is the XY axis, the plane of the XY axis, into infinity. In other words, the notion that you could create space that was didactically and conceptually horizontal, as opposed to layered vertically, as we have seen in the Renaissance and in Palladio and Borromini and Rinaldi and others that we have talked about in this class. So for the first time, the horizontal as an absolute vector, the extension of space in this direction as opposed to this direction, first of all, denies the perspectival view of the world, because the perspectival view, and that is the subject that we have known since Brunelleschi, and I say we have known, the people who are visitors don't know that, but the subject that these students know is a perspectival subject instantiated into architecture in Brunelleschi and carried forward to the moment where Corbusier says, no, we are no longer going to have a perspectival subject that sees space in depth, but in fact a subject that sees space extending in a sense, the x-axis rather than the y-axis. All right? That's a really important change. So now we have a change, in other words, a change, a displacement of the subject from the perspectival subject. And what does Corbusier bring into the world? He brings in the idea of the axonometric. That is a view that is no longer geared to the subject, but geared to the object twisted in space into three-dimensional space, either a 30-60 view or a 45 view, but never a 30-30 view, which a lot of you misunderstand as axonometric. All right, so the first condition is the layering of space in a horizontal way. This domino diagram is the basis for the 5 points of an architecture, towards an architecture for Corbusier. The 5 points were, first of all, the free plan. And of course, since we studied last week in Adolf Loos the round plan, the free plan is a condition where we use columns, the load-bearing structure, set back from the facade, set back from the edges of the plane, so that the columns and the facade are not working together, that the facade is truly a skin. It does not contain structure. And of course, this is the first point, or the second point, the free facade. In other words, once the facade is freed from structure, we have a way of designing facades which allows for them to be uninhibited by structure. What the columns do, setting back from the facade, they also set back from the walls, so that the free plan is a play of figural walls used to have
interpenetration of spaces in a way very different than the cubic, box-like, volumetric spaces of Adolf Loos, because we're now not talking about the space vertically, we're talking about the space horizontally. So the walls are free to interweave between the columns to give you what is called the free plan. The walls are not determined by the column locations. So that's two. The third is, since we have a free facade, the windows are not interrupted by the columns and interrupted by the walls of the rooms, and we can have what Le Corbusier called fenêtre en longueur, that is, strip ribbon windows. And again, this was the third point. The fourth point, which is very important, is that the pilotis take the ground plane off the ground and allow for the public space to run under the house. So there is a dislocation between what is public and what is private, which is very important. And this also leads to the first imposition of the idea that architecture is not site-specific. Now, I don't know if we've discussed this before, but the whole notion in contemporary sculpture in the 70s and 80s was about the fact that sculptors were trying to take the figure object off the pedestal and make them site-specific. Architecture has a different problem. Architecture was always trying, in fact, to make the buildings non-site specific. This is what we saw in Piranesi's drawing, where he moves buildings around from different times. So the pilotis act to lift the building mass off the ground and allow it to begin to think about itself as non-site specific. And the final point, since we no longer have private use of the land, we need to find a place for private outdoor space. And the next moment was the what was called the Trois Jardins, which is the roof garden. And Corbeau flattened the roofs and used the roof as a private garden space. So these are the 5 points to an architecture. Three other points that I want to raise. One, the idea of the domino diagram begins to make a critique of opticality. In other words, no longer are we just looking at something and saying it's pretty or not, but it's conceptual apparatus, what it means conceptually, not iconically, but as an index of a new kind of space. What it means becomes very important. That's number one. Number two, the diagram pretends to be a kind of pseudo-scientific mechanism. In other words, that we can restore a kind of logic to the chaos that was the architecture of the 19th century, that we can move away from expressionism and impressionism, which was the painting that had preceded cubism, which became a more logical, didactic kind of painting in the first years of the 20th century. The other thing which is really important in Le Corbusier is the difference in the way the subject, not only the seeing subject changes and how the subject sees, but how the subject moves through architecture. And what Corbeau does is he takes the tradition, there were two traditions in French architecture. One was the marche, which is the axis, the central axis of an academic composition, which allowed the subject to understand where he or she was as she proceeded through from, let's say, the entryway, the stairway, to the central space as we looked at in Palladio. This was academicized and given the term the marsh, the progression through space. The second traditional way, and this was in romantic gardens in the 19th century, was the promenade architecturale, the architectural promenade, where you would see different things, natural things, man-made things, fountains, sculptures, etc. Le Corbusier took the promenade architecturale and made it in a different way in the space. And what he suggested was that the car can drive, now we deal with the car, drives in and under, and as in Poissy, the house. You get out of the car and you enter a ramp, a spiraling ramp. And this spiraling ramp creates an energy in the space, a centrifugal energy, which causes a kind of vortex in the space as the subject is moving through the space. So the subject is caught as the car comes in onto another ramp, spiraling up to the roof garden. And so this changes the whole nature of the promenade architecturale from a static condition where the subject is moving through static placed conditions to a condition where the subject is on an architectural artifact that is also dynamic. And in many of Le Corbusier's houses, you either have a centrifugal, that is an outward thrusting vectoral force, or a centripetal force, which closes in toward the center. And of course, if we were to look at Cubist painting, and much of this comes out of Cubist painting, we realize that the canvas becomes a condition where there is a centrifugal force pushing objects and the center to the edge. In other words, instead of having perspectival space, the idea in Cubist painting is to flatten space, and in doing so, to push it toward the edge conditions, to create an edge stress on the canvas. So there is already a centrifugal motion in Cubist painting that is akin to the vortex in Le Corbusier's houses. The second diagram is the Maison Citroën. And the Maison Citroën is exactly the opposite of the Maison Domino. It is, instead of space being seen horizontally continuous in layers like this, they are wall spaces. That is, they carve space not perspectivally, but have a kind of bunker-like space that exists between two walls. And the ends are open, the sides are solid. And of course, this leads to the idea, in both cases, there's the idea of seriality. In other words, that the individual house in the horizontal diagram can be chopped up like sausage. And of course, in the Citroën diagram, it can be added to as row houses. So in either case, one is going this way and one is going this way. Now, the difference between Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe, both great architects, is that Mies never had a diagram. In other words, never had a conceptual basis from which to attack and develop his work. And of course, having the diagram as a basis tells you that we are moving away from the optical as a basis for the consideration of architecture. That is a brief introduction before we look at the images, because I've got we only have 45 minutes for the introduction and 45 for the pics, and we got to be out of here. So, are there any questions about what are? It is so clear. I mean, we shouldn't have any fluffling around today with the drawings. It is so clear what the critical elements are. Corbu tells you what they are, why they become critical, how they become employed. In other words, the two houses we did for today, Poissy is Domino, and Garche could be considered Citroën. But there are also variations in each one, so it's not quite clear. But are there any questions? You've got to get Corbu right, because if you can get, I mean, Loos is an hors d'oeuvre, okay? Corbu is a steak, right? Mies may be a nice fillet of sole, but Corbu is red meat. And if you don't get Corbu, you're not going to understand Rem Koolhaas later, you're not going to understand Frank Gehry, you're not going to understand any of the teachers who operate in this place. They may not understand Corbu, but you certainly have got to understand them. That's why I think it's really important. For me, one has to read Vers en Architecture, because to understand what Le Corbusier was about and how he operated. And I think one, if one could get a Christmas present, I think I said this before, I would have Mommy and Daddy buy me a set of the Oeuvre Complete, just to have to look at. And of course, as I said last week, I think it would be very useful if one were to say, okay, how do I clear away Le Corbusier? Well, the best way to clear away Le Corbusier is to do a project with the critical elements of Le Corbusier in your design studio, right? And to see, not to imitate or mimic, but to see if you can deploy the critical elements in a way that makes a project. And then you don't have to do that again, because you know how to manipulate these elements. And I think it's really important to do that. Just like I think it's important to do a project in the manner of a Rem Koolhaas today, to see if you understand what the critical elements are that are operating in Koolhaas. And the only way to learn is to take on the people who need to be done away with. And you are going to have to do away with all of your teachers. They are now your fathers and mothers, and in order to be, you have to be given the mechanisms with which they will disappear from your psychological makeup. As my friend Jeff Kipnis said to me, it took me 40 years to get rid of Colin Rowe, Tarragni, Corbu, in the writing of my book on Giuseppe Tarragni. I couldn't publish the book. It was done, and psychologically, it was clearing myself to become myself. So as Jeff is fond of saying, it took Hamlet 3 weeks to get rid of Papa. It took me 40 years. So hopefully, if I can make you aware of that, and the Oedipal problem, you will be able to deal with it. Corbu has got to be an Oedipal problem, maybe because he's an Oedipal problem for all of your teachers. So therefore, he's yours as well. And so I think it's useful to understand what makes Corbu an important architect. It's not that he did functions well. It's not that he said a house is a machine for living in, because his houses weren't machines. They looked like machines. And again, going back to the Albertian dictum that architecture doesn't have to stand up, has to look like it. His houses were not radical ideas of a new society. They were all built around servants. So there were servants' quarters, there were servants' entrances into his houses. So The social program of the House of Le Corbusier was not a radical program. The construction techniques were not a radical at all. The architecture was radical. The architecture was one that defied expectations of what it was an upper middle class house. So whereas Loos did it with an exotic sauce on an exotic, delicate piece of meat, Corbu hit you in the face with it. And I think to see the difference between Loos and Le Corbusier is very important. Any questiones? No, everybody is bananas. They get it in the drawing, so they got it. Okay, so let's look at some pics. They look tired. I've never seen a morsel. Right? Maybe we should all get up and sing. Okay. Domino, Citroën. But notice in both projects, what is the anachronistic element? The staircase, okay? And notice that this end is a cut-off end and this is a clipped-on end. So something, there's a clip here where the staircase is. notice that the columns on this end, and of course you find that in the article I wrote on Domino, the columns are closer to the end than they are to the side, and they're farther away from the end here. So there are distinctions, very important architectural distinctions about the location of the columns. And of course you're going to see that in both Poissy and Garche. What's interesting here, we have square columns, and of course in much of Corbu's later work we have round columns. And then of course the anachronistic element here is the staircase, which leads you in both cases, by the way, it's important that it goes to the roof. In other words, it's not just a ladder to the roof. The continuity of the staircase to the roof, that is, the occupation of the roof is important. And of course, the same thing here. We have here is the ground floor, the piano nobile, and the roof terrace. And of course, this is the important condition in these two diagrams. Next, please. And this is the Citroën as it appears in plan. You get the staircase from the outside. This is another model of the Citroën, but it's still the side walls. We have the staircase on the outside going up, hitting at, this is a two-story height space. The which is the ground floor entered here and here up to the next level, which could be kitchen, dining, or one could have living, dining, and kitchen down here with servants' quarters under here. Notice the circular staircase, which is a second staircase that takes you from the ground up, and then outside the finally to the bedrooms and the roof terrace. Next, please. Here are the 5 points Corbu's drawing. The piloti that take a house off the ground. So you have these two diagrams are part of the same point. That is, you have the point grid as opposed to the solid walls. You have the piloti here on the ground, and we have the roof garden, so that we have the roof garden and the piloti in both of these. So we contrast the pitched roof with the roof garden. Here we have the piloti with the walls that move around the free plan. Here we have the piloti set back from the wall so that you don't have individual windows, but this fenêtre en longueur, which is seen from the outside and then from the inside, it gives you a very different view, different frame than windows like this. This is a famous drawing by Le Corbusier, and this is the four compositions. This is the La Roche-Jeanneret house, which is purely, as it were, a figure cut out of a solid where the solid is not apparent. So this is the cutaway building. This is the pure solid mass building. This is the cutaway building, which is Carthage, the villa at Carthage, where you have the three figures within the grid, which is very different than this. In other words, there is now, this is a dialectical of cutaway, solid, and void, where all you read the void as a residue. Here is the pure cube solid, but here you have the dialogue between the figural element and the tectonic element of the columns, and you see it on the three different floors here. And of course, this then comes to Poissy, and where you have the situation where you have the dialogue between solid and void. Is it a solid cut away, or is this solid added to a void? And the whole idea that there is a balance between the solid, the black, and the void, the white. So these are a set of didactic drawings that are set up all of Le Corbusier's work all the way to the end, all the way to Ronchamp, to La Tourette, to Strasbourg, which is an inversion. When he gets to Strasbourg, he performs a self-critique of the work, and these diagrams that are done for the book, the first oeuvre complete in 1923. I think the first one comes out in 1929, but these drawings, I think, date from 1923. I could be wrong. Become the kind of, you have to understand what these are and what they meant at the time in terms of relationship to the house as a type. So this is a typology. This is Korb's typology here of the compositions and here of the points. That is the way you deploy the compositions as a didactic mapping of the way architecture could be. And this is very similar to what J&L Durand did in the 19th century when he did his Recueil Parallèle, the Édifice Moderne, which was a series of typologies. Here are the typologies that constitute the possibility for design according to the canon of Le Corbusier. Next, please. Here are the early studies, and again, some early drawings of existing houses and how you deploy the plan libre, the facade libre, the independent structure. And these are very important drawings, and this is now talked about as the town. And the town is unhygienic, inefficient, and I don't know what this trout. I guess this is something to do with crowdedness. And this is good circulation, good hygiene, good economy in the town that deals with this kind of building as opposed to this kind of building. These are the first drawings that he does, primitive drawings for the villa at Poissy, the Villa Savoie at Poissy, which is the first really, well, there are earlier houses, the Maison La Roche, Maison Cook, Cartage, others, but this is the really didactic house. And of course, what do you notice in the drawings is the importance of the circulation, that is the movement from the car up through the house. And of course in section we see the same thing, a section very much like, and that's why these houses are sort of between, but a section very much like the Citroën house. What we notice here though also is that the car comes up a ramp off the ground and you enter in here on one side, and then you either go down this circulation or across in this platform here. But you see the kind of energy of there is a dynamic condition to the object which contains the circulation, both in terms of the car and in terms of the pedestrian. Next, please. Here we have drawings, early drawings of the villa at Poissy, and also early drawings of the villa at Garches. There are a lot of changes that are made, but I think the important thing to notice is this is the ground floor level of the villa at Poissy. The car comes in around, and this is sculpted, this mass on the ground floor, so that the car can come in, drop somebody off, and then go and park in here. So the car becomes part of the movement system of the place. And then the ramp takes you, starts the spiral, and the ramp takes you further up all the way to the figural roof garden. The thing that is important to understand, again, is that the columns are pushed to the edge, the round columns are pushed to the edge on the side, but are set back from the front and the back. There is a slot of space on the front and the back, and a small projection out to the edge on the ground floor, in other words, to give you, as it were, a front facade. So the front of any building, in any classical or modernist sense, is always, as it were, the flattened side, in other words, so that the pedestrian to the car approaches something. And the rear is always figured. This is what it was in Loos, it's what it is in Corbeau, it's what it is in any architecture. Because this, if you approach from here, the pedestrian slides off. There's no container, there's no stopping, so that there is no, as it were, face. And so the rear is always that which is configured, and the front is always that which is flat. If any time you make a drawing of a building and you want a front and a back, because if you don't have a front and a back, you have no depth. In other words, if you don't distinguish between front and back, you will just have a slice of nothing that could be any thickness. So the distinction between front and back gives you the distinction of depth. And you will always be safe if you make a flat front and a figured back, because nobody could say, why did you do that? Because you can say, that gives you front and back, that creates a distinction. What's important to notice, when we go to Garsh, is that this has qualities of the La Roche-Jarre house, but it also has qualities of the Maison Citroën. And one of the interesting things is, again, this is the front of the house. This piece disappears. But look at how the back is eroded. In other words, the front is solid, the back is eroded, the garden is to the back. And also the movement, that is the stairs down to the garden, break out of the volume of the house and go down in the back. So again, the back is where the configuration occurs while the front is flat. And of course, again, in the space, what do we notice? We notice several compositional elements which are important. One, the fenêtre en longueur, and as if we didn't notice this, he puts a square opening in the wall so that there is the differentiation between the horizontal window and the traditional square window. And then what he does is the second important notation. And these drawings are didactic, notational, critical drawings. They contain information about what Corbeau thinks a space should be. What is the next dominant or the most dominant element is the column that sits in the space. Clearly the column could be in the wall, but Corbeau wants the column as a figural element, a round column, with an articulated beam here in the ceiling. And the next most important thing is the promenade architecturale, which moves up and through the space as a kind of dynamic element in itself. And of course, the subject participates in this dynamic element and eventually ends up in the roof terrace and goes back down to the garden. So also the space in Le Corbusier is always multi-layered in the horizontal plane. Now there are voids, as you can see, the compositional voids in the third composition or last composition, which says absence, solid and void become part of the dialectic of the spatial organization. There is always the double height space that opens up and bleeds into and provides a continuity in section very different than the spatial blocks of Adolf Loos. Loos's spaces connect through volumetric interpenetration, and this is planar interpenetration, that is, the planes are broken and interpenetrate in the space. So the round plan and the free plan have a different sectional attitude, even though there is the breakdown of the box in Le Corbusier. Clearly the box no longer exists in the free plan, but in Loos there is also that breakdown. And it is really important to study the difference in that what happens when Loos connects through opening from one room to the next. Next, please. Here are the realized plans and sections of the villa at Quassy. And of course, again, clearly to note the different location of the columns, the back slot, the front slot, which is clearly articulated now by this volume that comes out, and here on the second level. These are, again, not the final plans because this doesn't exist This is October 28th. This is 29. What's important to notice also is that while the plan is square, there is a graining to the plan. And what gives it the graining is these sort of small wall-like pieces that exist on these two sides. So the corners are not treated equally. The columns don't go to the corners, but the slot of space is now articulated. This particular slot is articulated by a solid. And so we get a in a sense, a directional condition this way. And this is the axial direction. And the space is, in a sense, a sandwich between this wall and this wall, because there are no wall-like projections. There are no columns on the other two walls. The columns are set back here and here. So here we get the plane, and the plane is articulated not only by the columns, but by these mini walls at the corners. And they don't define the corner as corner, but as a continuous projection of space out from this ramp. And of course, when you look at the section, Corbeau cleverly drew the section through the ramp. You begin to see how important the ramp is in the overall condition of the space. And it's very important. I mean, in other words, this house has been analyzed to death, but we could sit and talk about all of the moves that are made between October of 28 and 29, the changes in each of these plans, and what were thought to be, or could, what we could interpret or propose as the reason for these changes. Next, please. Here we get the villa at Poissy. It's important to see, here are the columns outboard on the two flanking sides. Here is that solid wall I was talking about. So the fenêtre en longueur only goes, and there is this kind of framing element here, whereas the windows go almost to the edge. There has to be, you know, some construction here. Notice the columns being set back, very important. Now, we can read, as opposed to Garche, Poissy in another way. Corbeau introduces the idea of the wall surface as a membrane. And what you get is a sense that there is two rubber bands that are stretched around, thick white rubber bands stretched around these columns. These are not a series of planes, although we could read it as planes, but as a continuous band around a series of sticks. So it's sticks and two rubber bands. You have the concept of a surface as membrane, whereas in Garche the surface are a series of vertical planes. These are demonstrably more subtle readings of this building, but nevertheless important to see in later work, because what he's doing is saying, how can architecture mine itself, that is its own internal discourse, to produce difference, to produce displacement? In other words, to see a solid facade as a membrane is a new idea. To see a house like Garche as a deck of cards is a new idea. So it's important to understand that what Le Corbusier was doing was trying to open up the architectural components, that is, the wall, the column, the floor and the ceiling, and the circulation, to the possibility of manipulation. And I think that's why this guy is a giant, a monster, whatever you want. Because he was able to, in a sense, stretch the conditions that traditionally were evoked in architecture in a different way. In the 1920s and 30s, there are a lot of white houses. They look like they are concepts. But when you study them and analyze them, especially the houses by Gouvrekian and André Lursa and Rue Spitz and Malet Stevens and other architects, minor monkeys, this guy is a giant because all of the moves are didactic, conceptual, and there is a meaning other than, oh, it looks like a white house, or it looks like a modern house. These are all set up to be initially diagrammatic, and secondly, oh yes, they're done in the White House style. So I think that those are the important issues when you begin to look at the difference between a Le Corbusier house and someone else's house. Now, of course, when we take Mies, and we look at the Farnsworth house and the column section in Mies, the whole difference in the column, how it's treated, this becomes the didactic element in Mies, and the changing column section becomes important. So there are no columns in Loos. Basically, the column is not a thematic element. The column becomes didactic in Le Corbusier, and also then becomes the thematic element in Mies. If Mies had any kind of diagram, it would be what I would call an umbrella, where Mies always has a roof and columns coming attached to that roof that meet the ground. So the ground is different than in Le Corbusier. The ground is a horizontal datum, and space is horizontal and extensive. In Mies, space is not horizontal and extensive. It is collapsed under what one would call an umbrella-like space. And of course, making this distinction is important to understanding the difference between Mies and Le Corbusier. Next, please. And of course, here is the drive under the Villa Savoie, and the view of it sitting in the landscape. Of course, if any of you have a chance this summer, I can remember a famous day back in 1965 when of a Sunday in Paris when I went with a Yale art historian who was teaching at Princeton at the time where I was, and we set off of a Sunday from Paris in a car, and we went to Poissy, saw Poissy, then we went to Garches, saw Garches, and then we went to Chartres. And at Chartres, instead of going to the cathedral, because there are not many ideas in the cathedral, we went and had a wonderful bottle of red Merceau 1934 and some fresh raspberries in a restaurant, got very drunk and took the cathedral en passant. I only tell you this because if you would like to know the name of the restaurant, I'll be sure to furnish it for you, provided you don't go in the cathedral. These are the two cathedrals that you want to see. Even though you can see the rose window, I mean, yes, you can walk in shot for a minute and say, oh, what a wonderful light coming through the rose window, and then you can go home. Next. That's for any of you who are going to Paris this summer. The roof garden, the ramp, again, these very didactic drawings. Next. And clearly the framing of the landscape is very important, not only in this house, but in Le Corbusier's mother's house on the lake in Switzerland, Lac Leman. the notion of the framed view, and of course this is comes out of Cubist painting, the notion of the frame in relationship to deep space and shallow space. In other words, the creation of a picture plane from which to view landscape. Next, please. Here is the villa at Garches. You all read Mathematics of the Ideal Villa by Colin Rowe, where he talks about the relationship of this building of Malcontenta of Palladio to the villa at Garches, and the kind of A B serial relationship, where which is something we would get to if we got to Kahn, where the servant and served spaces, which is a classical idea in French academicism. But what's important to notice is that this house has two entries and two canopies, a major one and a minor. This is for the public. This is for the servants. The servants are on this side of the house. Notice the main space. There is this swooping form that leads you to the circulation system. This time is taken. This is like a pinball machine up through the staircase up here, and then again further pinballing you into this space. I mean, it's Corbusier's houses are really like giant pinball machines. Next, the front facade, the Fenêtres Longueur. There are no side facades in Garches, and what's important to understand is the whole notion of Cubist space in Cubist painting was that the deep space was flattened into the frontal canvas, whether it's a still life of a bowl of fruit on a table, the table is tipped up into the vertical plane, or it's a painting by Cézanne of Mont-Saint-Victoire, where the mountain is collapsed into a series of layers. Garches, when you look at Garches, you can read the plan because, in a sense, the horizontal plane has been conceptually tipped up into the vertical planes. There are no sides. They're flattened into, and this is meant to be a building that continues in a horizontal direction. It could be one of many row houses. So you read Garches as opposed to Poissy as a Cubist painting. Next, please. And the early drawings by Le Corbusier of these buildings. I think the early drawings are an important way to go through an analysis. Don't forget we've got this slot on the side, just like we do in Poissy and in Palladian space, so that the facade is detached from the side plane. The punctures in the side wall, as opposed to the Fenêtres Longueur, the garden terrace, and then the stairs down to the garden in the rear. Next, please. The roof terrace. Next. Got it. We moved quickly today because we have to evacuate. Are there any from my class questions about what we saw? Yeah. Right.
How does he do that in the setting of Savoie and the landscape? It seems like he puts it in a really open space. He makes this discrete floating object, which would just
right.
add to its perspective.
Well, but the thing is, if it were in the round, in other words, at one point it's in the round, but it's denied because of the location of the columns. I mean, in other words, the spinning that occurs is in the ramp. In other words, the centrifugal motion is not the building, but it's the space that's caught in these two hard walls on the side. So there is this spinning energy that is contained. In other words, in Corbu, there's always an action and an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, the thing has to remain static. It can't spin, right? And so, yet the ramps and the circulation systems, the promenades, are dynamic elements. So the building is a frame to contain the figural element of the ramp, the figural element of the subject on the ramp, and the dynamic condition of the circulation space. So the way the walls are set up, those two side walls had to be like that, or the whole thing would be spinning, and therefore there would be no dialogue between movement, counter, point, counterpoint, which was the basis of the Hegelian dialectic and the dialectics of the aesthetical dialectics that Le Corbusier was working with. And clearly in Garsch you have a series, it's very different, you have a series of vertical layers of space that trace through the house, which make Garsch a very different condition than Poissy. But those side walls are very important to the Hegelian dialectic that operates in Le Corbusier. Now, clearly today, if we're arguing about the Hegelian dialectic in Le Corbusier, what architects today are trying to do is to overcome that dialectic. In other words, the attacking focus is on the Hegelian dialectic. How can we overcome those 19th century possibilities? And much of the attack of what we'll see later is an attack on precisely those points that Le Corbusier, in a sense, fetishized in his work. Other question, yeah.
You're ready to talk about the side.
Yeah. It's conceptual. In other words, what I'm saying is you can read the plan, that is the side and the back and the front. It's like a cardboard house that conceptually is flipped in. If you look at the front facade, you can read the whole plan. It's not literal, right? In other words, that's not the case in Poissy, because you can't read the sides from the front. You can't read the plan from the front because there is no front, because in a sense, Garst is an arrested spinning. But it's like a cubist painting. The space is flipped into the picture plane, right? It's not literally flipped in, but it's conceptually flipped in by the angles of the perspective, the way the table is drawn, the way the fruit and the bowl sit, that you feel the space is like taken like a cardboard box, right? That you want, take the bottom out, you flip the sides up, and you flatten it out. Garsch is like a cardboard box, and Cubist painting is like a cardboard box. It's not literal. It's the analogy to it. You're not literally folding the sides. You're folding the sides in your mind. Any other questions? Okay. If any of you who are new student looking, if you want to just take 2 minutes before the dean comes in to look at the drawings that the students have done. They're right next door. I think it's really instructive to take a look and see what first-year students can do. I wasn't bad today.